Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, bootleg billions inside South Africa's exploding illicit booze market, how new labor laws could reshape jobs and business in South Africa, what Gen Z is really doing with its money, and how artificial intelligence could unlock South Africa's youth potential. It's Wednesday, the 18th of June. Now, the label might look real, but the cost is anything but. Illicit alcohol in South Africa is quietly becoming a national crisis, with new research revealing a staggering 16.5 billion rand in fiscal losses in 2024 alone. That money, meant for schools, clinics and safety, gone. And the public fallout, well, obviously, it's even worse. I want to explore this in some depth now. And joining me is Dr. Shamal Ramasar, Head of Research at the Drinks Federation of South Africa. Shamal, a very warm welcome. And let's start with that big number, 16.5 billion rand lost. Why is illicit alcohol growing this fast?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks very much for having me on the show. Absolutely. 16.5 billion fiscal loss is a huge number. And I think when we explore the research and we look at what are the real drivers behind the growth in the illicit market, the first and foremost things that's come through was the affordability. And what we started to see is that consumers have a demand for low-cost alcohol products and sometimes even willing to purchase illicit alcohol, knowingly purchase illicit alcohol because they want to have a certain brand, even though they are aware that it could be even counterfeit and be associated with health risks as well. So affordability is the number one driver behind the growth in illicit alcohol. The second one that we see through the research is accessibility. Now, we've noticed over the last couple of years that operations in the illicit alcohol market have become absolutely sophisticated. Now, this was largely driven by the post-COVID, where the COVID lockdowns on alcohol showed that there was a huge demand for even illicit alcohol in South Africa. And this led to highly sophisticated manufacturing operations that's in South Africa and globally as well. And because of the sophistication, we find now that illicit product is not only confined to your informal channels, we're starting to find them in your formal sectors as well. So even branded retail stores can have these type of illicit product. The third one is the scale of operation. And like we said, because there's such a high demand for it, these operations have scaled up where, in some raids, they're no longer backyard manufacturers. They are now sophisticated manufacturers with hundreds of employees, in fact, in these type of production facilities. And the last one, of course, is unfortunate, and that is the poor or weak enforcement that we have in South Africa. Now, it's no big secret that we are under-resourced in terms of law enforcement. And because of this, these type of operations are allowed to grow. And that is largely the drivers behind this growth.
Let's get to enforcement in just a moment. But what I find quite astonishing is that almost 50% of buyers knowingly choose illicit products for price. How do you change behavior when saving money outweighs health concerns? It seems as though the issue is now completely entrenched.
No, 100%, Jeremy. And, it's going to take a whole of society approach to change this type of behavior. And at the DFSA, we really are committed to going on a huge public awareness campaign purely to show the public the dangers of consuming, especially counterfeit alcohol. you know, from the study, Jeremy, we found that counterfeit alcohol has now overtaken even smuggling and tax leakage to become the number one type of illicit alcohol in South Africa. And further studies conducted by the DFSA, for example, through the University of KwaZulu-Natal, showed some of the harmful chemicals that are found in these counterfeit brands. Some chemicals such as methanol, for example, which is deleterious to human health and can even cause death. And these are the type of things that are unbeknown to, you know, your general consumers who are willing to purchase, you know, branded products at a cheaper price, knowing that it could possibly be counterfeit or possibly cause health effects or health concerns to them.
So let's go back to law enforcement. 31% of the market counterfeit, 23% is smuggled. It tells us a lot, doesn't it, about the level of organized crime, cross-border failure, and the complete inability of the authorities to enforce any kind of strategy.
We must also, you know, pay a bit of credit in terms of law enforcement, because it was the number one type of illicit alcohol in South Africa, and it's now dropped down to number two in terms of its ranking. But it's still a massive number, and that's, you know, testament to the porous borders that we have, but also to the sophistication of the operations that these illicit alcohol manufacturers run. And it's not just going to be one department in terms of law enforcement. It's going to be a multi-pronged approach. So that includes the likes of your SAP, your SARS, your intelligence agencies, and so on. That's going to have to try to all come together to have a plan to combat illicit alcohol.
Just finally, you mentioned health concerns, and there's no doubt that this issue is now a ticking time bomb. 29% of people knowing someone who's been harmed, 37% knowing someone who's died from illicit alcohol poisoning. How come this is not a national emergency right now?
On a point of correction, it's 29% know of someone who's died from illicit alcohol. But absolutely, that means one in three of the respondents that took the survey reported to know somebody who has died from consuming counterfeit alcohol. Now, this is not quite strange, because, Jeremy, you would remember that in December last year, we had our South African artist and his fiancée who were traveling to Vietnam on holiday and consumed alcohol laced with methanol and unfortunately demised. I think a month before that, there were four of those students who were on vacation in Laos and consumed shots that were laced with methanol and also died. So this is becoming a huge problem in terms of mortality. So not just in South Africa, but globally as well. I think because it is underreported, Jeremy, it's why it's not considered a national emergency. And really, that is one of the biggest mandates of the DFSA, is to raise this type of public awareness. And we're doing it through this type of research, where we're showing what the consumers are doing. But we've also taken it a step further, where we've analyzed the actual components in counterfeit alcohol and, you know, placing a huge emphasis on why these type of chemicals are going to cause serious health concerns.
Well, thank you very much indeed for sounding a very serious warning. That's Dr. Shamal Ramesar, Head of Research at the Drinks Federation of South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might be aware that South Africa's cabinet has approved the National Labour Migration Policy and the Employment Services Amendment Bill. Two major labour reforms that will reshape how foreign workers are employed in this country. These policies introduce sector-specific quotas on foreign nationals and enforce stricter penalties for non-compliance. It's a move, government says, is aimed at balancing economic inclusion, protecting jobs for locals, as well as encouraging skills transfer. All well and good. But what does this mean for employers, for foreign nationals themselves, and the wider economy? I'm going to talk now to John Boerter, who's Joint Chief Executive of Global Business Solutions, a leading voice on employment and labor strategy. John, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Just a little bit of clarity in brief. The key changes introduced by these two bills, what are they and why should we be concerned about them?
Good day to you, Jeremy, and the listeners. I mean, the first big issue is a philosophical shift away from, you know, South Africa's relatively open approach historically to labor migration. And that particular shift holds significant impacts on employers that employ foreign nationals. effectively they'll have to perform a due diligence on the foreign nationals that they have, and then use this legislation in order to ensure that they don't fall foul of the law.
Government says, and if I've read this correctly, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, government says it'll help protect jobs for South Africans. In your view, then, does it strike the right balance, or is there a chance it could risk hurting businesses?
My personal view is that there are definitely jobs in South Africa that could be filled with South African citizens and help address the unemployment crisis. Of course, unemployment went up by 1% in quarter one of this year to 32.9%. So, Jeremy, I believe there are certain positions and a number of these positions at semi-skilled level, unskilled level, and even at junior management level that could quite relatively easily be filled with local colleagues rather than foreign nationals.
So, if we look at sectoral quotas as a bold move, are there sectors, in your opinion, that are most likely to be affected? And the quotas that we're talking about, are they realistic based on current skills and availability, do you think?
Well, let's first talk about the quotas. The Employment Services Amendment Bill gives the minister this massive, massive authority to impose not targets, Jeremy, but quotas. So these quotas will apparently be subject to consultation. So you're looking at agriculture, hospitality, tourism, and construction. And those are the starting point because those sectors traditionally employed relatively large numbers of foreign nationals. So the downside of that is with these quotas could come potential investment flight out of the country because when multinationals invest in South Africa, obviously they are accompanied by expats to some extent. So that's a potential threat. And then there are certainly skills that are going to be required that might not in the short term be subject to skills transfer. I mean, if you just think of agri, for example, with the seasonal requirements and the immediacy of those requirements, you don't transfer those skills and those numbers very quickly.
So what does a practical, workable skills transfer plan look like, in your opinion? And I guess the challenge would be to avoid it becoming just a box-ticking exercise.
Yes, look, I mean, effectively, there are boxes to be ticked. So, organizations that employ foreign nationals will firstly have to understand how many foreign nationals they employ. Bearing in mind, Germany, that like the Department of Labor specifically know exactly how many foreign nationals are employed by virtue of employment equity plans that have been submitted. So, companies will have to firstly understand how many of these individuals there are. Then, the second issue is this. The legal standing and the legal status of these individuals, because, for example, the Zimbabwean exemption permit and the Lesotho exemption permits expire at the end of November this year. You've also got many people from or foreign nationals that are on work permits and visas. So organizations will have to really get the house in order, understand the legal status, and then how their roles may be affected, because if they are critical and core skills, Jeremy, and if those companies are absolutely confident that they'll be able to demonstrate that there's a lack of those skills in South Africa, then they will be fine to continue. But they'll first have to demonstrate that they went and advertised, they even used employment services, and they still didn't come up with those skills. So these companies will have to really go about their work properly from a documentary point of view.
And if they don't, the penalties for non-compliance, I understand, have increased sharply. So maybe break down the risks and liabilities for companies who fail to align.
Well, there's significant risks and liabilities, as you say, Jeremy. I mean, the first thing is the Employment Equity Act. You know, has got certain targets that have been set for 2030, and if companies don't make reasonable progress, they can face fines of up to 10% of their annual turnover. So you and I both know that very few organizations have got profit margins that size. Then the previous fines of around 50,000 rand have been replaced by much more onerous fines, also ironically ending up at about 10% of annual turnover for habitual offenders. And we've also heard of the most senior officials of businesses being arrested where these foreign nationals' documentation have not been in place. So, I mean, there are potential criminal, civil, and legal consequences, labor law consequences.
So you mentioned a little earlier the importance of due diligence. What should employers be doing right now to prepare for compliance?
Well, I believe they first of all need to truly ensure that the current foreign nationals' documentation is in place. That's the first thing. The second thing they need to do is to determine which of those foreign nationals' skills would likely be able to be secured locally, so that they can start with that particular process of delineating between, you know, whether or not they've got critical and scarce skills, as in the Government Gazette that sets those out, and they've got a greater chance, therefore, of remaining in South Africa. Or if their skills are not critical and scarce, they're going to have to start transferring whatever they need to transfer in terms of those skills and start looking at how to exit those foreign nationals. And then your whole labor law component comes into that, because your foreign nationals are protected from unfair dismissal as much as anyone else. So these organizations might very well find themselves in a position where they fall foul of potentially unfair dismissals and the like. So these organizations really need to, I think, classify their workers as in critical and scarce skills or not. Secondly, do they have legal documents in place? And then thirdly, what are their prospects of obtaining an extension of their permits and work visas?
John, I'll just need a quick answer in conclusion. From a business confidence perspective then, is there any concern from your end that this could deter foreign investment?
I am concerned about that, Jeremy. You know, we've got many clients who employ foreign nationals, you know, in senior positions in particular, you know, at top senior middle management level, because of their interests financially and also the IP, the proprietary information that they have. So it is a concern from an investment point of view. And then secondly, you know, even at lower levels, there are some very specific skills that potentially, you know, one would lose. But Jeremy, having said that, you know, I also don't see organizations making or taking steps, reasonable steps to transfer skills in many instances. And I think, you know, I think that's where the balance has to be struck.
John Boerta, thank you very much indeed. Joint Chief Executive Officer of Global Business Solutions. I do appreciate your time.
Join the South African Guide Dog Association in the Give a Cane campaign running from the 5th of May to the 18th of July. Help us provide 1,000 white canes to visually impaired people by donating just 50 Rand. Your donation goes towards white canes and training, which helps our clients stay in touch with the world around them. Want to do more? Host your own fundraiser, get your book club, social group, school involved, or encourage your community to donate just 50 Rand. Be a part of someone's journey to freedom. Visit www.guidedog.org.za for more information.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Side hustling more than job hunting, paying rent and investing in crypto. South Africa's so-called Gen Z isn't, by all accounts, following anyone's rule book. They're rewriting it. All of that is according to a newly released Gen Z Economy Report by Student Village and Flux Trends, and it deep dives into how young South Africans are earning, saving, spending, and I guess surviving in our very fragile economy. It is a very important economic cohort. Joining me now from Student Village is Chief Executive Ronan Ayers. Ronan, a very warm welcome. And you say Gen Z isn't broke, they're building. What do you mean by that?
So when you speak to them, they'll say, today I'm broke. But when you actually dig a little deeper and see what they're spending on and what they're saving on, it's actually phenomenal. So we surveyed just over 900 young people, predominantly students, and most of them are saving up to a third of their income or income streams on various things. So relative to the rest of the country, they're actually saving a lot more than the older cohorts.
And it's a very resourceful cohort, isn't it? Your report highlights that just under 17% of respondents identify as unemployed. It's surprising, and I guess the question is, what does it say about how Gen Z defines work? Very different to you and me, I imagine.
Yeah, totally. They're rewriting the playbook on how we do things. And when you look at things, well, students by and large are unemployed. But really, with the reality of the economy, the big unemployment stats are true for the real economy. But what's happening in the informal economy is there is a big focus on side hustling, which is creating my own business. Some of them have part-time jobs, and most of them are actually gearing towards, well, they're using technology and their passion to create a business, and they may or may not get the opportunity to join the formal economy. But if they do, they're generally going to have a side hustle, which they're hoping will get momentum and steam, and they will go into that direction in the future. So they're really marrying technology, passion, and really hoping that that will be their direction.
And it's a demographic that is deeply comfortable with technology, Ronan, but here maybe is the conundrum. The report also says that cash is king. 80% use it regularly. Is that a rejection of digital banking, or maybe a symptom of something, maybe deeper financial mistrust?
So when you look at it on the surface, it actually doesn't make sense, because they are digital natives, and only 2.5% said they want to go into a bank branch. More than half of them have accounts at multiple banks. So they're not loyal. They like to tap. They don't like credit. So only 15% have credit cards. But what we're seeing when we speak to them through deeper conversation is that it's partly a legacy of the past, where 80% prefer to use cash. So they'll draw out the money as it comes in. They see that as risk mitigation, so no one can take my money from me. And they also see it as, I guess, less of a regressive tax for the fees for every tap.
And also, Ronan, nervous, anxious about credit, which we know is scarce anyway these days. Should banks be responding to this, what I would say is maybe a generational resistance to debt?
So what we're seeing is I think this is just a knee-jerk response from either seeing their parents, their siblings, or family really living in the debt trap. And so they're trying to almost recorrect or self-correct the family's trajectory. And so they prefer things like buy now, pay later for transactions. And really what financial institutions should do is to really help them along with financial literacy, how to budget, create different products that are friendly to perhaps building their side hustles, and helping them understand the value of healthy credit versus unhealthy credit. Because we're seeing some really interesting behavior on the other side, because they're saving, and they're saving a huge amount proportionally to their income, but they are investing in things like crypto. So they're very crypto curious. About 30% of our cohort said they've got crypto. And they're even seeing things like betting apps as a way of either investing or earning. So they certainly have a high risk appetite for returns, but they don't love credit.
And let me try and get my baby boomer head around this one. You say that Gen Z spends as much on clothing as they do on rent, but it goes deeper. Not for vanity, but for identity. Just explain this link then between self-image and financial choice, because I'm battling.
Yeah, so it really doesn't make sense if you just look at it at face value. The thing is, in an economy with scarce opportunities in the formal market, what they're really saying is they're taking a bet on themselves. So they invest in things to look good, to show that they have arrived, and that usually opens other doors. So if they're content creators or influencers or in the digital economy, when you invest in yourself, even as far as Ozempic or investing in your lips or your eyebrows or your shoes, that often opens other doors to other gigs and opportunities. So for someone like you and I, it doesn't sound rational, but to them it makes absolute sense. They're taking a bet on themselves as opposed to the country.
And also interesting is the adherence to saving. So saving over a third of their income, and often people within that cohort would be earning less than 5,000 rand a month. How do they pull that off?
So I think they're really good at just at this. They've developed this muscle to start saving. The thing to bear in mind is it's not long-term saving. So only 5% of the cohort are actually saving for retirement. This is generally saving for, again, to bet on themselves. So to either further their education, build their business, so to buy new equipment, etc. They're not the generation that are actually into ownership or where possessions are king. It's all about investing in themselves. So it's to get them further.
It's investing in themselves, but maybe a slight counterpoint to that is there's also a strong community component, or maybe it's complementary, because often income sources are shared between family, partners, and friends. And this says a lot about the collegial economy in practice, doesn't it?
Definitely. And just to be a bit more outright about it, that, you know, they used to be sole beneficiaries from multiple sources. Now they're part of the contributors to multiple people. So they know that they have to save for a rainy day, and they know if the family calls that they have to answer.
You also say, or the study also says, that this generation doesn't want gimmicks. They want relevance. I understand what you're trying to say, but where do you think brands are getting things wrong in that respect, and how do they need to rethink or recalibrate their approach to this influential young group of consumers?
So one of the things which is quite interesting, if you use an example, like say of a brand like Spotify, if you want to listen to music without ads, you've got to pay for it. So young people, if you take the same kind of approach, they would prefer to have an ad-free world, but they understand that that's part of it if they want things for free. At the same time, they don't want brands to be their friends. They want to, it's more transactional, so they don't want to be friends. And also, they don't want brands to try hard. So don't try to speak my language. Don't try to be cool. Just actually give me value. Give me respect. And you'll get my loyalty, even though I'm not a loyal person by design.
All of that is contained in the new Gen Z Economy Report by Student Village and Flux Trends. And I've been talking to Ronan Ayers, who's Chief Executive Officer of Student Village. Ronan, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in a country where youth unemployment remains staggeringly high and access to personal coaching is limited to a privileged few, a new breakthrough may be quietly changing the game. There's new research from the Stellenbosch Business School, and it reveals that artificial intelligence could fill that coaching gap. It would empower young graduates and entrepreneurs with tools once reserved for executives. Joining me now is Professor Nikita Blanche, Head of Leadership Coaching at the Business School. His team is pioneering AI-powered coaching tools designed to build confidence, emotional intelligence, and resilience among young South Africans. Professor, a very warm welcome. You've described AI coaching as a democratizing force. What makes it such a compelling solution in a country where, I guess, there is limited access to human coaches?
Yes, good morning, Jeremy. Yes, indeed. And as you said in the introduction, we know from research that coaching, executive coaching, leadership coaching is a very powerful one-on-one personal development intervention, but it really is very expensive and unaffordable. And we have now, with the advent of generative AI that the listeners will know as ChatGPT and some other models, we've incredible power now to create AI-driven coaching chatbots that can, although not completely be as efficient as a human coach, it can approximate aspects of human coaching to a remarkable extent. And we've shown this in randomized control trial research studies. So it's very exciting that we can now finally offer aspects of coaching and self-development at a vastly reduced price to literally millions of people.
I'm interested in the chatbot notion. Your studies also found that cognitive behavioral coaching models work best via the chatbot. Why do you think this style is having such a strong impact then on emotional intelligence and obviously yielding some degree of result?
It was actually a surprising finding. You know, it's such a new field that with any new technology, it's very important to do proper research to understand what we can and cannot claim. So in this particular study you're referring to, we created three different types of chatbots. The one was purely goal-oriented, and the other one was solution-focused, and then the third one was cognitive behavioral. So not to get too technical, but we were surprised that the users prefer the cognitive behavioral chatbot, which tells us that people are actually willing to engage on quite a deeper level with AI than we previously thought was possible. And the advantage of cognitive behavioral approach, of course, is that it challenges patterns of thinking and behaving, and then helps the person set goals and through experiential learning actually change those patterns. So what's exciting about that is that the research shows that people are willing to engage with these chatbots, not just to find superficial answers like how people might be using ChatGPT at the moment, but actually to go on a journey of self-discovery and deep introspection and to actually change deep-seated patterns of thinking and behavior.
Professor, what kind of mindset change is needed among people who are being coached, who are participating in this new way of receiving the assistance, given that the warmth of human interaction in coaching models previously has been so important?
That was another interesting research finding. You know, we were also, I'm myself an executive coach. I've been coaching for 15 years. But with my engineering background, I moved, trying to combine the two. And when I initially did studies on people's perceptions of AI coaches, one of the surprising findings was people over and over telling us that they feel psychologically safer with an AI coach than with a human coach, which was a bit of a shock to me as a human coach. And when we looked a bit deeper, we realized that even though human coaches, even therapists, are trained to be non-judgmental and to be neutral, people still are triggered by the presence of a human. So it's not only positive aspects of interacting with a human coach or therapist. There could also be negative aspects. Whereas with the AI, of course, it's completely neutral. And I suspect what's happening is certain personality types and certain types of people would prefer interacting with a robot or a chatbot rather than with human coach or therapist.
One of the concerns you've raised, if I've read this correctly, is cultural context. So how important is it to develop tools that understand South African realities? Localization, I guess, is critical.
Yes, I think we have to understand. So the chatbot that we've created that we've over the last 6 years is called Coach Vici, which comes from the Latin Veni, Vidi, Vici. I conquered. And this chatbot is a combination of using ChatGPT, but also built-in theories and models of adult learning and applied psychology. So I maybe should just give that context. So because we use ChatGPT as an engine, we have to remember that ChatGPT and most of the large language models are trained on data from the internet, which is predominantly represented by what we call the global north, right? Europe and America. So there's significantly less data in these models from South Africa. And in one of the studies, we did find with entrepreneurs specifically that they liked the chatbot and they liked the fact that it could help them set goals and motivate them. But they did feel that there was maybe a cultural nuance missing that wasn't particularly well represented in the model. So the call to action there is for us to actually invest money for the government, for organizations, to customize some of these large language models with a South African specific flavor to it. I think that's inevitable. It's also important that we don't fall behind with what's happening in the world. Yeah, I'm attending a conference at the moment in Europe as we speak, and it's incredible to see the amount of money and effort and thinking that's going into this. And I'm just worried that Africa is falling behind again in this digital divide by not being preemptive of investing our own time and resources so that we have AI that represents our culture.
So as far as the national investment is concerned, so you'd be looking for support from, I guess, the CETAs, also the National Skills Fund. Is there any warmth towards your call?
You know, it's such a new field. It's tough being a first mover, as our listeners on this station would obviously know. So trying to convince people, first of all, that coaching works, human coaching, is one thing. And then I bring in the angle of artificial intelligence coaching. So people are curious, but I think they need to be braver and they need to give it a try, because the research studies have shown over and over that it works. So it's all about educating people in CETAs, like you say, in government, about the incredible power of leapfrogging what we're struggling with, and that is to roll out human coaching. It reminds me a little bit of mobile money. Many years ago, I was involved in that. And with Africa lacking banking infrastructure, we were able to leapfrog that backlog by introducing mobile money using airtime as payment. And I see this very same opportunity here, where if we are preemptive and brave, and in a sense, to use AI in this context of coaching, it could be an incredibly powerful way to help our youth, unemployed, anyone really who needs self-development and goal setting and being more productive.
Professor Nikki de Blanche, thank you very much indeed, Head of Leadership Coaching at Stellenbosch Business School. I do appreciate your insight. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.